manipulation, to manage yourself. That is the whole purpose of developing the...
Did you hear?
Listen to the Church of Mavis radio show, hosted by Jeffrey Pritchett, 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights. Follow your weird and journey into the high strange. Be sure to stop by
www.churchofmavisradio.com
for upcoming shows, paranormal news, and show archives. That's
www.churchofmavisradio.com.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Citizen Sane Radio. It's going to be a little bit different tonight because Guy isn't with us. He's on a road trip having an adventure, and I hope that it's most excellent. So tonight, jumping into Guy's shoes, I've got Chip Pleasure from Mind Cemetery Radio, and our guests are Thomas Reed and Robert Morningstar. So what we'll do is we'll start with Thomas. Will put you in the hot spot for now, and if you kind of give us a little bit of background about what it is that you're pushing out there now, because I think your case is really quite stunning, and I'm really impressed with the kind of paperwork that you've got to back everything up. So actually, Chip?
Yes, hello.
Hi, I thought I'd bring you in and say hello as well, because
well, you were rolling with it so good, I figured, why stop a good thing? get out of the way, chump. That's what I was thinking.
I'm just leaving for dust. I just talk. I have guests on, and I don't know why I bother, because I just do all the talking.
Well,
I'm
going to
try to behave myself tonight.
That happens sometimes.
Okay. So at least you know you're there anyway. Right, yes. Okay, Tom, so hit us with it. Okay. Where do... You know, what happened to you when you were little, and then...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think what, you know, a lot of people, I think, saw, you know, Alien Mysteries, which actually did a pretty good job of our history. And, of course, you know, Uncovering Aliens came out a little while ago, which I think left out an awful lot. They had a lot of information. So I think what I'd like to do is just kind of, I think I really do have to start from the beginning because there's so much that is left out. You know, there's an awful lot that the, I guess the networks don't feel is fits in their box of what they want to air. So
they have to stop the time. Really, stop the same.
Yeah, I think the what I'd really like to point out is that our family had a very it was a lot of layers to what took place, and we grew up, or at least for the better part of my childhood, I grew up on a farm, a horse farm in Sheffield, Massachusetts. And we had three days, I guess you could say, or three accounts that our family really experienced together over about a five-year period. My mother had a restaurant in town. It was called the Village Green. It was in 113 Main Street, right there in the center of town. It was a very small town. And there was a country club that was about 7 miles from our home. Now, the encounters that we had on our property, and in some respects, I don't think are that much different than what other people have experienced. But what was really unique about our case, and what I think I'd like to really share with everyone, is that unknown to me that at the time, there were about 40 to 50 people at Jug Inn Resort, which was in Egremont, Massachusetts, not far from our home at all, that had seen this craft over our property. And there were, because it was like a semi-private club, there were doctors and lawyers and, you know, the pillars of the community that were members of this club. So there was actually a CE2 classification given to the craft that was over our property that was seen 7 miles away at this country club. And there were about 40 or so on people that actually gave testimony. With that said, and I'll get into the actual what took place later on, but what was interesting about that is that later on in the 80s, my father ran into attorney Robert Blackman, who at the time was the public relations director for MUFON. And this is so wild the way this came to be also, is that Blackman actually worked with J. Allen Hynek way back when and was able to dig deep and see that our case back in Sheffield when we met him, was telling him what would happen, was able to pull up records to see that our case was actually given a CE2 classification due to Jug Inn Resort. So at that point, yeah, it was really just, in some respects, if you look at the facts of this thing, we were very lucky to have that connection at that point. And given that my father was running for office and everything, he was a respected individual in town and that sort of thing. So it gave Robert a lot of insight, and he was really interested in it because he was actually working with Muhammad Ramadan at the Parapsychology Society within the United Nations and organizing a symposium to talk about these, you know, the UFO cases, if you will, with respect to this 33-426, which was actually a, I wouldn't say a bill, but it was a what the UN wanted to have a unified agency or group that everyone could filter their information regarding, you know, crafts and that sort of thing from all over the country, being that SETI was a big thing back then and they were introducing a new microwave vault technology. So what if they find something? We want to have one unified agency to be able to filter all this stuff too. So Robert looked into our case because he was able to pull up information by J. Allen Hynek through the Egremont Country Club sightings and reports, and that's how it ended up going or being mentioned on the backside, if you will, to some other cases at the United Nations and on October 2nd, 1992. Now, the TV shows and that have been out there and the interviews and things that more people are familiar with really seem to focus on Brownsburg, which, oddly enough, just really focused on my brother. And there was some actual evidence to that. There was radiation readings that were taken from the vehicle. I've even got emails that came from the police officer. I've been able to keep those as well. And there were magnetic fields around the vehicle. And that was recorded on camera. Even Debbie Cobble, who the book Intruders was written about, actually was able to get some footage of that too and give it to us. So we have that information as well. And so we really do have a lot of, I think, facts behind our case. And then, of course, what has driven me to talk about it really is the fact that my father actually was going to write a book about it and lost his life. Well, you know what happened, but He was killed on the same day, October 2nd, the same day our case went to the UN, 14 years later after talk of writing a book about it. So that is what has really driven me. Mm-hmm. As far as the case itself and as far as what happened, I can answer any questions you'd like. I don't know where we really left off last time, so I don't want to repeat myself, but,
well,
if you have questions,
okay.
I mean, that's really the, yeah.
Basically, well, you were both, it was you and your brother, wasn't it? And I remember you telling us that your brother had seen a light coming through the window, or both of you had seen these lights coming through the window, so you went to see what they were.
And
you
house,
vanished
right.
for a good few hours, didn't you? You went off on a little...
And to be honest with you, Alien Mysteries actually did a very good betrayal of what happened. I mean, to be honest with you, if you want me to tell you a little bit about that, I mean, what was interesting about that too.
Yeah.
We were at the, this was 1967 actually, and I was on the bottom bunk, my brother on the top bunk, and it was kind of a strange thing. There was I think this is something that I don't stress enough about either, is that there's a actual feeling that your body picks up on. It's different than you just know something's wrong. It's not an anxiety. It's not a you're not nervous or anything. It's just kind of a like a calm, almost like a still dead, if that makes any sense. And that you can sense something's there. You can sense you're not alone. It's almost like you're. Sometimes it's almost like you're looking in your own room from a distance, and you sense something. It's almost like, it's very weird to describe, but I was at on the bottom bunk, and I felt something very strange. It was a very weird feeling in the room, and I remember looking at the closet, because the closet had a little crack in it, and I was staring at that, and I can still see myself doing it. I mean, I can still picture this feeling that I wasn't alone in this room, and then we saw, my mother came in first to shut the window. She thought it was going to be a storm. So she said, I want to shut the windows, guys. There's lightning or whatever. And we didn't have air conditioning. So she thought there was going to be this big storm and everything. So she had just come in, so it wasn't that late. It was only about maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. And I was looking out the window, and I saw what looked like a ring, almost like a flashlight where it's solid, more like a hula hoop. And of light that was about the size of a dinner plate, and it was probably, I'm going to guess, maybe 100 yards outside my window, and I just noticed it because it was so dark, and I just was looking at this thing, and I was in conversation with my brother, and the next thing I really remember, it was as if I was inverted. It was as if I... If you've ever been, and I've mentioned this too, that it's almost like being in an ocean wave where you're just sucked up and you're flipped around and tossed, and everything, it's like a whitewash, not like a cotton, but like a dirty white wash. And I felt like I had flipped off to the right side and almost upside down for maybe a half a second. But I actually almost, it was like I felt it, and it was almost like I didn't know which way was up. And I remember feeling this flipping feeling, and then... That was the last thing I really remember from that experience in the room. Now, my brother, when I speak to him about it, he mentions how there was like this flash of light, almost like in a he mentions it. He says it that it when light fired is how he words it. It fired into the room, kind of like just the room just ignited in white, and I was no longer in the room. And so that is how. What happened with that moment? Well, my brother actually runs out he goes down the steps of the bunk bed and out to the hallway, and he runs into my mother's room, and he tried to wake her. She wouldn't respond. My grandmother was actually sharing the master bedroom with my mother that night, or actually for weeks, because I had an aunt from Hollis, Queens that was actually visiting. She had leukemia, so she had taken over another room, and so my mother was not alone in her room either. My grandmother nor my mother would respond to my brother. He was trying, he's screaming and pushing and crying, and he actually ended up getting between the wall and my mother and pushing her with his feet, and she wouldn't wake up. She wouldn't respond. And finally, I don't know how much longer it was, but she did finally come to, and my brother, Tom's gone, Tom's gone. And something that Alien Mysteries didn't show was that my mother actually had come out at the top of the banister where the stairs were with Matthew to go to my room, And for whatever reason, they stopped for a second as they heard what sounded like a slamming of doors, like if someone took the doors in a home and all slammed them at the same time. They heard this bang, just like almost like a double boom, like a bunch of doors slamming just a second or so off from each other. And then my brother was no longer standing next to my mother. And so they show an Alien Mystery. They show my brother looking over the banister and stuff. That's not really true. They came running out to the across the hallway, and there was like a boom. And that's and you know what's interesting too is that we don't really know in between these things how long it happened, like that slamming the doors. My mother doesn't know if she blacked out for a second. All she knows is when she looked around, Matthew wasn't there anymore. And I remember Matthew, and at the same time, I actually remember being in a hallway that wrapped around almost like a question mark with very high walls. It was very white. And I was at this break, I guess, at the hallway going into a very dark room that was, I was not alone. There was a figure next to me to the left. And I remember at the time being somewhat panicked because this was actually the second time that something had happened to us on our property. And what I believed to be the same vessel, if you will, that that I was on. And I was in a bit of a panic because I could not see my brother. And the first time, I think there was a comfort. I've mentioned that before, too, you know, having someone with you, even if it was your brother or whatever. You know, someone that couldn't help you or whatever, but at least you have someone there.
And this is not on your own.
And I was looking for Matthew, and I remember being, you know, kind of like... I guess crying, you know, or whatever, and next thing I know, Matthew's with me. So the way we kind of figure this is like, what happened with me? Maybe because I was not cooperating or in the state that I was, maybe that's why Matthew was brought to me, or was he going to come anyway? But that's really what happened at that. I guess if you were to watch Alien Mysteries and you saw that event that they portrayed, it was actually pretty good. I mean,
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but you know, I wasn't kicking the top of the bed and playing with Matthew. We were actually in a very weird funk. You know, we were kind of, you know, spooked, I guess is a good word for it, and very quiet and very still. If you've ever gotten to the point where you're like really afraid, you don't want to move because
I'll breathe.
See you move. Yeah, exactly.
That's what
it was like. I wasn't going, hey, Matt, you know, kicking the top and fooling around. He's not going, stop it, Tom. You know, that didn't happen. You know, we were just in a really weird state. And then when Matthew came running back out to tell my mother or coming back to the room, she was actually with him. But anyway, that's really what happened at that moment. And so Matthew was with me he had a club foot, too. He had a brace on his leg. And he remembers a lot of attention being put on his leg with the brace on it. Mm-hmm. And something else they didn't mention, my brother used to, and this is strange, but he had like a blue and yellow tugboat, like a rubber tugboat thing. And he had that with him. And, you know, it's kind of like we remember little bits and pieces of things. We can't remember it all. But he remembers seeing that little blue and yellow tugboat, you know, in a room. And he doesn't really remember how it got there or what had happened. There's an awful lot that we don't recall. But so there was an awful lot that did.
It's an awful lot that doesn't actually make sense, is it? I mean, in some of my memories, it's so snapshotty and jumbled that you can't really kind of figure most of it out, but you just have had sort of little mini snapshots of memory that over the years when I've not been afraid to go back and look at these events, little bits have come back to me, and I actually always think, I don't know how I forgot that, how the hell did I forget that, but you do, it's incredible. Even my children, they've had experiences. And they forget, even my daughter, she painted a picture of something she'd seen, and I mentioned it to her, and she'd forgot. She went, oh, I forgot about that. And I said, well, don't you remember painting the picture? She was like, oh, wow. So I can see, by looking at my children, how memories develop, change, and vanish over time. But then we have to start to think we remember a little bit more when we get older. But, you just can't even control what comes back to you, can you?
Yeah, and we pretty much, for the most part, we don't really remember too much more now than we did then, but there are little things that we don't talk about because we can't make sense of it, and I wouldn't even know how to relay it to you. And I'm going to tell you something I've never mentioned before, because as anyone, you'd understand. But I remember, it's really strange. I remember being in what looked like a clear white translucent, surrounded by like clear white translucent walls that were rounded, and I could actually see through it, almost like maybe like a clear shower curtain, maybe, or something that you can't really see clearly on the other side. Mm. And I remember being in this little cocoon type thing that maybe was maybe 15 feet around, and seeing figures. And I remember screaming and kicking, "Get away from me! You know, get away from me!" You know, and I just remember that for like a 4 or 5 second clip. You know, I remember, crying out. And yet I tell people, you know, I don't really think anything horrible happened to me, because I don't really remember anything horrible happening. I remember crying, and I remember being panicked, and I remember being nervous and scared. And I remember how it felt and how the crickets erupted around our car, and how it affected the wildlife and the feeling you get in your stomach. I know, and it's almost as if sometimes you're looking into what happened from another, it sounds crazy, but it's almost like I remember seeing my room, and I remember looking at it from what I believe to be almost like a mirrored existence of my room. Like I wasn't really even there. So either this is something that happens to your head through these electromagnetic fields. I think it played a part of it because of it. There was ELF around my brother's vehicle. So maybe that changes the way you think or feel about something. Maybe that's even why you feel nauseated like I did and disoriented a little bit. But I remember, crying a couple of times and kicking and I don't talk about it much because I be honest with you, I don't remember much more than that. I don't know why I was scared. But then again, I say to myself, you know, if I'm sitting at home and I see someone looking in my window while I'm watching,
you're gonna jump.
You know, I'm gonna jump too. You know, so. Maybe that was it. Maybe it was fear that I created within myself because it was different, because it was something I wasn't accustomed to. It certainly destroyed my, you know, what I would think is a normal life for a child. I mean, I was an altar boy. Did you know that? I used to carry the cross in our church. My mother had bachelor's in ministry. A lot of people say, well, you know, this affects religion and this kind of thing. No, if anything, we went. My mother started going to church every Sunday after that. I mean, we didn't know what to make of it, you know, and so it really did affect our family in a lot of ways, and we had that restaurant in town, and after I drew that sketch that hung in our fourth grade classroom with all the others from all the other kids that saw something and tried to sketch what their parents saw, and of course it was on WSBS radio, which broadcast at 1969. I'm actually going on the radio station that broadcast our case the very first time in 1969 on my birthday in a week. So that'll be interesting. But, there was an awful lot of heat that came from it. My mother was single at the time. A lot of people don't know that either. And so she would open up the restaurant, and a lot of the kids would come to the restaurant after school because it was actually right across the street from the school. You could walk to the school from there. A lot of kids left their bikes in the back and would ride, you know, in town afterwards. And the parents would come in and give my mother a hard time. And, you know, if you want to see something out of this world, Nancy, you know, we'll show you something out of this world. You know, that kind of just kind of slobbish stuff. And so we did end up moving after the incident in 69. And so we really thought that was the end of it, except what happened in 2009 with my brother, which really kind of had everyone looking back and saying, wow, you know, this is one of those cases that was actually mentioned at the UN. And again, it wasn't really a big deal back then. I mean, it was only on the back burner of some. Our case was not a big deal. I mean, there was the Greece Ministry of Defense was talking about things, and you had, you know, the Pentagon had documents. I mean, this was just, you know, Robert just said basically, look, you've got a case 45 minutes outside New York City with a very, you know, respected family who had something happen. This isn't just isolated to other countries. This isn't, that's all it was, you know?
Yeah.
But the fact that it had that connection, I think is what really, you know, gained attention to this case. But
what happened to Matthew really blew the lid off everything, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And that's what's right. Exactly, and that's what everyone focuses on. Everyone focuses on Brownsburg because it's fairly recent, all things considered. But what they don't understand, or what, you know, I think, it, what happened in Brownsburg is nothing different that happened in the 60s with us. It's just that it's more recent, you know. And I think because there were emails that came from, you know, Detective White, and there was, you know, even Chase Klutsky, you know, got involved in it, you know, through the Star Team thing, and some other people that, you know, put a lot of time into it. So it had a lot of, it had a lot of recent attention.
Yeah.
But I think what I think is important that gets lost in all this is the aftermath that took place regarding my father, and I think the information that he was able to gather, you know, that was sent to him after the United Nations, and of course you've got Robert Blackman who took it to the UN, whether or not he, his death following my father's was natural or not, you know, he was directly in, or had a very good, played a part, an important part in our case. And then, of course, Michael Buckner, the doctor who evaluated my son and was going to, you know, speak out at a conference, actually, believe it or not, about what he found in, regarding a heightened ability with regard to, I wouldn't say ESP, but he tested higher than in a coincidental chance consistently. And so that's a third person that lost their life around our case. So it's a very...
you should take each one and say, oh, that's a coincidence, and the
car,
that's a coincidence.
Right.
But then when you look at all them coincidences together, you know, you just think, hang on a minute, it's not possible for that many coincidences to occur.
No, and then, right, and then we've got this, and then we had this guy sit me down on my front steps of my house from Key Point Government Solutions and this kind of thing, asking me questions about, am I going to leave the country, you know, and this, you know, am I savvy with computers, and I've been, you know, run off the road, and I ended up going to the DA's office. I was actually with my attorney while she was going to see a judge to have some information authenticated. I think I talked to you about that once before. I mean, these things just don't happen to anybody, you know. I mean, it's strange, you know, I'll be happy hour with my friends, right? And this stuff doesn't happen to other people. You don't have an FBI agent come to your house. You don't have groups you've never heard of from the government sit you down in your front steps of your home. You don't. You have something extraordinary happen, which in my thinking is has a lot of value to this field. Our case offers something. I think that's what it is. There is something here. There is some value here, and for something that extraordinary to take place and to have somebody that. In your family that actually had a voice like my father did, and to be killed on the same friggin' day, you know, and then have the CDC come in from Atlanta and close down the friggin' building that my father was working out of, and it's been condemned and shut down to this day.
Yeah,
you know, come on.
Yeah, they found a virus in the air conditioning unit,
right? And then the New York Times actually said, well, you know, Howard Reed, blah, 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 you know, dies from a case of Legionnaire's disease. Oh, right. A 56-year-old healthy man is going to die in 24 hours from Legionnaire's disease, and they're going to condemn a building by the CDC? Come on. That he didn't. Now, all he knows is that there were red luminous sticks that were actually found in the air conditioning unit, and they found some broken glass and things. Whether or not it was connected or not, I don't know, but there was glass in there. They thought it was like it could have possibly been something that was dropped in there and broke. It just could have, again, just could have been a combination of things. But they did have fresh ceiling tiles in his office. Why is that? His laptop was in there, and the C drive had been formatted. You know, you format the C drive and wipe it out. So his computer was dumped. I mean, give me a break. And so this is, to me, what's important, you know, and not so much, you know, the light that my brother was following in his car that, you know, that that Uncovering Aliens did. I mean,
that's another part of the story. The story
they actually had me at the doctor's office. They filmed taking blood. You know, they actually showed the Rh negative factor and how, you know, my brother and I had, whether or not that's relevant or not, but they did film that. They interviewed my attorney. They did a very, very good job at filming and capturing on tape a lot of very strong testimony from a lot of different people, but they never used it, you know, and they never showed it. So,
and you passed the polygraph test as well, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the questions are quite simple. Just have you ever been untruthful about any of the things that you've ever said about all of these?
Yeah. I was taken down to Knoxville, and actually Detective White said, how that happened was after 2009 when they found this the radiation and the magnetic fields around my brother's vehicle and that whole scene there. I think it really got a lot of people's attention, like, okay, there's something here. So White said to me,
validates everything that's gone on before as well, doesn't it? Because it's a continuing thing. And then when you've got trace evidence like that, and Matthew has obviously been very much affected by this event as well.
Exactly. And so they're like, well, you know, take a polygraph test, you know, because he hadn't he wasn't aware of what happened in the 60s. So they brought me down and I sat in front of Jim Morris and he had a setup right across. He was a 30-year, he was a retired police officer of 30 years. And so I sat in his office and I sat across the desk from him and I talked to him for hours, just like I'm talking to you. I told him everything. I told him about the craft and what it looked like and how it was near the path and that whole wishbone tree, and we saw it and, you know, we were on it. I mean, the whole thing. And it was so involved, he just basically, White wanted him to focus on what happened prior to 2009. So he focused on 66, 69, and asked me a couple pertinent questions and basically just said, hey, did you lie to me? Did you lie to me about anything?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I told you absolutely the way it was. I don't have...
Yeah.
You know, I, the minute I say something or exaggerate or add color or anything like that or an assumption, then suddenly I lose credibility and I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you exactly the way it was.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't make sense. I try to put it across the best that I can, but it doesn't always fit. All I can like this whole thing with me screaming and get away from me. I don't remember. You know, who was coming
at me. It's a jigsaw piece. It's a jigsaw puzzle with a lot of pieces missing.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes,
Robert.
Please. I was asking if you
have... I'm intrigued by this report, the two things, your reaction to fighting them off, which is exactly what my little brother did when he was 7 years old, when he was taken in upstate New York. But I have a question about the radiation traces that were found around your car and your property. When you found that out, did any authorities come and check it out, like Environmental Protection or Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Was there any official investigation? Because the radiation on property is a very significant thing.
Right.
And I was wondering... Was it just handled through the police department?
What happened was when my brother made the report, and first of all, it was the first team that came out was that funded team. It was right after the STAR team had gotten funding through that Robert Bigelow funded team. They came out and they found it and they reported it. And then Chase Klutsky was ahead of the MUFON part of the STAR team. They came out and they found it and they recorded it. And then my brother, through with the other people that were there, went to make a police report. And so a police officer came out, and they were discussing it. But they said they couldn't make a police report because there wasn't an actual crime. So they were trying to say, look, there's radiation here. But they took soil samples, and actually they did not find it in the ground. They did not find it. They found three hot spots on my brother's vehicle. But they were sending out because the funding, I guess, for the – I got to be very careful here. Through the Bigelow funded part of it, they sent the samples out to colleges. And when the colleges did not get back to them, they said that the soil samples had no radiation to them in the official STAR team report, if you will. However, that's not really true. They never got the soil samples back. So we don't really know for sure if it was actually in the soil or not. But there were three hot spots, they said, and I've got the email, and I think I actually sent that to you, an email that came from Officer White that specified they found what they referred to as hot radioactive or radiation hot spots on the vehicle. So there wasn't
Whose Geiger counters were used, and how many different, whether there's a STAR team, they found radiation, so they had the Geiger counters. When the police came, did they use their own Geiger counters?
The police never actually took a test of the... When the police came out, they were trying to make a police report. You know what they said to my brother right in front of everyone? Well, you need to call NASA. And my brother says, well, the funded team from Bigelow Aerospace is here, so theoretically they're already here. That was the exact thing they told my brother. You need to call NASA. They made such a joke out of it, I couldn't believe it. So Detective White actually interviewed the people who found the radiation and did a report off of those people. They didn't do he didn't do a report off of the local Brownsburg Police Department.
You really should have contacted the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the Environmental Protection Agency if you really wanted some federal, you know, intervention. And you know, it occurs to me that this person who came to question you about details recently may have come specifically in regard to that. You know, like a cutout. There's a saying, the term called a cutout. It's a person that's used as an intermediary between an official agency through a semi-official agency or an unofficial agency or person.
You're talking about the June 6th visitation I got.
Yes, I'm talking about that. That there may be interest, unofficial interest, but semi-official interest. And as I said to you, the security apparatus for UFO and UFO-related phenomena like abductions was divested by the U.S. government under Richard Nixon. And by that I mean they said, okay, we're getting after the Colorado University of Colorado faked a research study which was intended to get the Air Force out of the UFO business by saying, we've investigated all of these thousands of reports and there's no substance to UFOs. So the Air Force says, see, okay, it's official. The university says so. There's no UFOs. We're out of this business. When that happened, it really wasn't true that they were out of this business. It just molted like the same snake shed skin, you know, and secret programs are like snakes. They keep slithering through and changing the skin. So what happened is that Nixon turned it over to military-industrial complex. Basically, the defense industry has its own security apparatus, and they became responsible for UFO-related phenomena. And they're the ones that are the shadow players. You see, so by the U.S. government, the open government, has plausible deniability. It's not us because we're not involved in UFO. The Air Force got out of the business in 1969. You know, if you see something, call NASA.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing.
Let me ask you something. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Yeah.
You want to ask something, sir?
We still have the video of the magnetic fields. We have those people who still filmed it, the original footage for that. We still got the reports, the emails about the radiation readings. At this point, my attorney was trying to or looking to get what they call a memorandum of law written on what happened because we're actually working on that right now. So any advice I'm open to suggestions because that is exactly what we're working on right now is getting everything authenticated. We're trying to bring it before a judge. And of course, you know, I've what happened when we were run off the road and everything about that. But
yeah,
so that's what we're doing right now is and emails, I think, if I'm not mistaken, are also a legal document. So we have not only the documents from when the radiation readings were taken, the testimony, the personal testimony from the police officer, the copy of the official stuff, copies of the Bigelow and Star Team reports about the radiation, and I've even got the emails. So I would think that I could still, if I'm not mistaken, still use that to, what did you suggested I speak to?
I suggested, you know, radiation on your property is a very serious.
Wasn't on our property. This wasn't.
On your car?
The three spots were on the car that were on the side of the road when my brother, when my brother went off the road.
You own it.
Yeah.
So if your property is contaminated by radioactivity, it's very important to find out where that came from.
Oh, yeah.
So no, I would say, you know, the people who are responsible for that, HAZMAT, Environmental Control Protection Agency, or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I'll tell you something, Tom. the government agency that really was the umbrella agency for UFOs in the 1950s was the Atomic Energy Commission. Once they found out that UFOs involved radioactivity, that there were radiation burns to people, there was radioactivity created interference with communications, all kinds of stuff. It's like dirty spots. Vegetation, for example, saucers would land on a spot of soil that had grass and life, you know. Once it left, the soil was dead, you know, several inches down. Nothing would grow, not absorb.
We had that, too. We got pictures of that, actually.
Okay, well, that's the kind of thing that radioactivity will do. It'll kill life anywhere in its vicinity, depending on its intensity, you know, the damage.
Yeah, these are almost square-looking.
No way around it. In the 50s, I have reports from eyewitness reports, a young kid whose father worked at Oak Ridge writing to me, after he heard me telling that.
That's 5 miles up the road from me. Right,
Tennessee
right.
Valley Authority, in 1946, his parents were driving to work. They worked at Oak Ridge, and they saw a lead-colored oval UFO that was just hovering over the TVA plant, and then all of a sudden, zip, it was gone, you know? And they saw it, they made a report, and that's how far back. They are incredibly interested in radioactivity, nuclear facilities, nuclear weapons. There's a book called Nukes and UFOs by Robert Hastings, which is probably one of the best books on UFOs ever written. It's really well documented about UFOs intrusions into nuclear missile bases, weapons depots. Missile-based stories are incredible. They'll come in and disable missiles, or they'll activate. They actually started a launch, but only because we have manpower. At the very last moment, the manpower overpowered the automatic launch sequence. Then they go in and they also change the targets on the missiles. They were able. It's a really famous story.
It's actually some of the documents that my father had from the Greece Ministry of Defense. I think I even might have sent you one. Talks about how the F-4 fighter jets were paralyzed from firing their weapons on this craft.
And I met the pilot. That happened to. He's an Iranian F-4 pilot. He's a general in the Iranian Air Force. I met him in Washington. He told me all about it. And I had some other information for him that related to an abduction that happened on a mountain in Iran on the night that he was doing that interception. He intercepted the craft. It fired something at him. It froze his, his electronics and created a lot of heat in the cockpit. He broke off. Then he saw the craft descend and land in the desert. Then he went back the next morning in a helicopter. Long story. But the story I had to tell him was that I found out that two people, a British doctor and an Iranian colleague of his who had been on a holy mountain in the mountains in Erbus, had been abducted, were gone for almost 3 days. When they woke up, they thought it was overnight. They were taken out of a cabin on a mountainside. And then when I told him that, he told me, you know, this is very interesting because where I saw the UFO land is where those mountains are. So he may have been chasing the UFO that kidnapped this British doctor and an Iranian, and took them for quite a ride. Took them a ride over Europe, Yugoslavia. They saw Paris. They saw London. They saw New York. And all at night, and then they came back, and they found themselves sleeping on the road about 75 feet from where they had left their car. They thought that it was the next day. They drove into Tehran together, didn't say a word to each other, were kind of in a numb, kind of trance-like state, got there and realized that it was 2 days later than they thought. And your account of your struggle resistance against the intruders. Reminiscent of my own little brothers, he told me that they couldn't handle him, that he struggled. They kept saying to him, open your eyes, because they have an overpowering gaze. So his strategy was to keep his eyes closed and fight them and kick and bite and everything. But they were able to overpower him, and he was able to remember that 30 years later when we met again and reminisced, you might say. People don't have background on this story, but Tom's experience and my family experience is very similar in that they were abducted as young boys, and my younger brother, when he was 7, I was 12, was abducted. This was 1962. And he didn't see any UFOs or flying saucers. He only saw the creatures who he described in a 7-year-old child's vocabulary. Scared as he was telling me, he said, they looked like little munchkins. They were really small, 3 feet high. They were like standing in the flowers. And they tried to use hypnotic suggestion and telepathy to persuade him that they themselves were flowers. But it was quite a traumatic experience. It changed his life forever. But imagine my position that I received my first alien abduction report at the age of 12 from my own little brother in 1962, and that's how long I've been studying this phenomenon. And I have had my own close encounters, and it's, as Tom described, it's a very, let me say, confusing, befuddling experience, because you've been told that nothing like this can possibly exist, that it's not rational to believe in it. Science, is stonewalling on every level. And that if you do encounter this phenomenon, the first thing you're supposed to doubt is your own sanity. You know, but the wonderful thing, pardon my expression, but the wonderful thing about your experience, Tom, is that it happened with your brother, your mother, and your grandmother. And just like being in the craft all alone and feeling terrible until you saw your brother and had company, the same thing applies in the aftermath, in that the four of you have the experience, have the knowledge, have the certainty, and can support each other and have supported each other. A lot of people don't have that, and they're thrown.
If it wasn't for, I think, the love that we have for each other, we would have lost our sanity a long time ago. I mean, we were very supportive for one another. I mean, that pretty much is what I think saved our lives, for lack of a better word. Were you able to look up and find any information on Muhammad Ramadan?
You know, no, I haven't. I got that document right now, just now. And I'm really fascinated by the fact that a parapsychology society has existed at the United Nations since 1969.
Nobody
knows
about it.
You know, I know a little bit about UN stuff and their attitude toward it. They're very serious. I actually met the UN ambassador for outer space affairs, Maslan Othman, on October 14th, 2010. And I had the privilege of meeting the chairman of the Peaceful Uses Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And they told me quite directly that the UFO issue is considered in the United Nations, but nothing's going to happen in the General Assembly until something comes, or an official request is presented to them by one of three international societies: the International Society of Astronomy, the International Society of Aeronautics, and the International Society of Astronautics. One of those three societies has to petition the General Assembly to take seriously some evidence that is presented. This evidence is to be presented to them. If they approve of the quality of the evidence, they will submit it to the UN. And that I got directly from the ambassador for outer space affairs, Maslan Othman.
Right. I've seen quite a few documents and minutes of meetings from the UN in the 70s where they're discussing how to address the UFO issue. How do we, kind of introduce this into the general populace?
without everybody freaking out. And I mean, these are like 40 years old, these minutes.
Yeah, I'm fascinated that Tom was involved in this. I've known about this for ages. But I did not know that Thomas Reed and the Reed family were directly involved with it. Another very interesting part of this is the reason that this UN event was happening was the request from the Prime Minister of Grenada, Mr. Geary, Eric Geary. And the story behind this is amazing. Eric Geary, Prime Minister of Grenada, used to do business in a hotel, and he like a club. He didn't have the White House, but he just was a regular visitor at this hotel that had a wonderful restaurant, and that's where he'd meet people and do the business of government. So one night, someone drove up and told him that there was an emergency that he had to attend to on the other side of the island, that some fishermen had found something that he had to see, that the police had it, and it was imperative that the Prime Minister go see this because they didn't know what to do with it. So he drove out there, and when he drove out there, the fishermen had found the body of an alien, 7 feet tall, had 6 fingers on his hands, had
about
a
minute to break.
He had washed up.
Top of the hour?
Okay, yeah. We're at the top of the hour. Pick up on that.
It was a good cliffhanger. He found a 7-foot alien. What kind of alien was it? We've got a few seconds.
Yeah, it sounds like a tall white to me.
Tall white, yeah. Now, I actually believe in tall whites. I don't believe in everything, but...
this may be the reason for the invasion of Grenada.
Right.
There's a cover for getting down there to take this body back. It was in the medical school. It was preserved in the medical school. Wes Bateman, who passed away, sadly, last year, wrote a wonderful report. He was an intimate friend of Sir Eric Geary, and I published the best report on this event ever on the old UFO Digest, and perhaps it can still be found. Wes Bateman, WESBATEMAN, and I worked very closely with him, and I'm able to tell you this from someone who was there with Sir Eric Geary.
Are we on
well,
break,
I think we'll come back to that after we've had this break. Because that is pretty interesting.
Are we on or off?
I think we're going to be off any second now.
Okay.
Past lives,
the afterlife,
divination,
exorcisms,
witchcraft,
the unseen.
He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Fireman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Is reality. The connection is you. Check out Catherine Buckley on Truth Connections Radio, Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on 107.7 FM, the Paranormal Radio Network.
Whoa! Did you hear?
Listen to the Church of Mavis radio show, hosted by Jeffrey Pritchett, 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights.
Follow your weird and journey into the high strange. Be sure to stop by
www.mavis.com.
churchofmavisradio.com for upcoming shows, paranormal news, and show archives. That's
www.churchofmavisradio.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Welcome back to the second part of Citizen Sane Radio with me, Sasha Christie, Chip Pleasure, Robert Morningstar, and Thomas Reed. Just before we went to break, we were talking, you mentioned the 7-foot alien in Grenada.
Yes.
And they
washed
if you'd
up.
Like to finish that.
Yeah. Well, there's several fascinating parts to this. He was apparently... the alien washed up. Something apparently went wrong with a breathing apparatus. You had been off this reef, and the box that the alien contained, which was recovered when opened, had a whole group of tropical fish of similar but different species, as if there his purpose was farming or mixing tropical fish as if he were restocking the reef. Is one of the assumptions that aliens are interested in marine life and nurturing it and as well as studying it. So the body was taken to the medical school in Grenada and put on ice there. And that was the reason that Sir Eric Gehry asked for that meeting at the United Nations. And it was during that time, shortly thereafter, that Morrison Bishop, I believe his name was, took over Grenada with a communist insurrection, killed the vice president, and shut out Sir Eric Gehry, which led to Reagan invading Grenada in order to, quote-unquote, free the medical students. When the medical students got back to the United States, Reagan said we didn't need rescue. So some people believe that it was a cover story. The taking of the medical college was one of the primary missions of the Grenada invasion. And some people believe that it was the primary target was actually recovery of the 7-foot alien body that Sir Eric Gehry had originally recovered. And Sir Eric Gehry never got back into power after that occurred. So that's one of those intriguing asides that not many people hear about. Another thing I should tell you, there's a lot of code word and jargons and mixing of terms, different vocabulary. We call things UFOs. I found out that the United Nations is interested in something that they call ultra-high-frequency objects.
All right.
So... once I learned that, I figured, oh, they don't call them UFOs. They call them UHFOs, ultra-high-frequency objects. So you're never going to find any documents, you know, as far as research is concerned, with the UN. But it may be if you start looking for ultra-high-frequency objects, you might hit pay dirt.
Same as they'd be calling them UAP. You know, the unidentified aerial phenomena, you know.
Right, exactly so. Exactly so.
Nice. When we were listening in the first hour there, Thomas was talking about basically what I called a detention cell that he was put in that was translucent, that you could see through kind of like a fog glass type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very similar to that, I guess. Very tough to see through, but yeah.
I'm not on the level with you other three, with Sasha or Robert or Thomas with your abductions, okay?
Okay.
I've seen some things and, you know, outside the window and all that, and if I was abducted, I don't remember anything from certain points, point A to B, and to tie it in with Robert and what he was saying, the your brother resisting by closing his eyes and you getting put in kind of solitaire for a while, it makes me think that those are the points that you became difficult to handle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that I would like to have figured out eventually, or start asking these questions along these lines when it comes to abductions, handlers, you know, medical staff, security.
Yeah.
Who's doing what around you? You know what I mean?
Those are
the kind of things that I'd like to see more abductees try to start deciphering and figuring out. Are the people that come on the ground and pick you up, is that some sort of security group that comes out and gets you? People that have, you know, a group that that knows you because you've been abducted multiple times, knows your family bloodlines, like you were saying that you said that might have something. Yeah, I'm in that camp that it does have something to do with it. You know, the RH narrative.
Well, you could say that, but I've had so many different types, you know, over different years and different parts of my life, from being young, being in my 20s, you know, and then my 30s, now I'm into my 40s.
Yeah.
I've seen, for the first time 2 years ago, a tall grey. But I don't think they were there in my house for me, because I was still in bed and basically had been immobilized in my bed. So obviously there was something going on with kids. You know, but I've seen little blue things, I've seen little beige things. I've seen a little girl, well, it was obviously, I don't know what it was, like some kind of reptilian, but it looked like a little girl until I was shocked, because obviously I was in an abduction scenario, went to grab all of her child, like any mother would do, you know. And then when she grinned, she had a very reptilian teeth and eyes, and her face just kind of, all the human skin sort of bunched up at the side. And then behind her, there was like something large and dark blue, very hulking kind of shape. Didn't see the front of it, so I sort of assumed that he's another sort of taller lizard, but I really don't know that. But then the tall grey that I saw in my bedroom 2 years ago. I think, well, if that was the case, I would have always seen the same things. And my friend Paula, she always sees the same ones, but I haven't, and I don't know why that is, you know. And when it's like that, I find it even harder to build a picture out of my experiences, because they're so absolutely remarkably different from each other in every way.
Right.
So, you know, for me, that would be really hard. And this is why I talk to other people, because when other people have seen the same things as I have and have similar experiences, that's where I get my, you know, kind of maybe more thinking about at the bigger picture of each different set of ET or interdimensional.
Well, you look for similarities too, I think. You know,
because that's the only mirror that I've got, because otherwise it's just me and my brain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when
we all keep a little something aside too, and when someone else hits on it and we've never mentioned it, then you kind of know. That,
yeah, well, like, you know, Matthew is a black box, and my friend Paula is a black box, and another lady that I talked to is a black box. So it's same size, you know, everything in description.
And then there were
the really unusual specifics that I look for, because it's hard to make sense, and, you know.
Well, there were these little, I was actually in Cincinnati, and I was at a table with Travis and a few others at Scarefest, actually. And it was one of the first times that I mentioned that there were these, and I mentioned this to Robert, actually, about 3 years ago, and even he found it, I think, interesting.
that there were these what looked like packets of like raisins, like a big about half the size of a golf ball maybe, and there were like three of them. I referred to them when I was young as rocks. You know, they looked like uneven, not spheres, but like uneven, almost like a big raisin rock looking thing. Uh-huh. And they were actually placed on my body, and one was like on a leg through a came through like a hole on the side of this thing that was where her hand, I guess, came through and put one on my leg. There was one on my side or that area, and there was one put on my face. And I had never really mentioned that openly before because, again, I can't really make sense of what it was or what it did or anything. And it sounds silly in some respects. It's not something people ask you. You know, they want to hear the more, you know, interesting aspects of it. But Travis mentioned that he had something very similar like that placed on his face. And it was one of the first times that I had had something that I never mentioned before, and then suddenly it hit me that, you know, it's the mm-hmm. little things that make all the difference. It's the things, little things that you share with people that you find, you know, that you're not alone in what happened, and it's a little detail.
Well, there's another case that reminds me of yours, but you know the ants, the giant ants that you saw, the big red ants. Now, the Flatwood Monster case, if you look at that, the creature, it was like in a mechanical suit of some kind, but it had a red face, and it had just kind of like a slice of a mouth. Maybe, you know, if it didn't have the headgear on, it might have had like a kind of ant-type face, I have no idea. But the one thing that really did it for me was the case at the bottom of this body armor or whatever mechanical thing that it was wearing. If those creatures that you saw pulled their legs right in, it would fit into this. But these things were reported to have two long red arms with only two fingers. And I thought, well, look, that's how they were portrayed in the alien program that I really liked, the one that was good, that they did about you. You know, when they portrayed those big ant-type aliens.
Mm-hmm.
The arms and the colour were exactly the same as the Flatwood Monster, even though that was in a sort of mechanical suit of some kind. And that was really well documented right across America. Frank Fischino kind of followed the trail. But, I just thought, well, that's very, 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 very similar, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good...
That's what you look for. Yeah,
I think the Flatwood Monsters was some kind of an alien probe. And the aliens, kind of in a dumb way, they tried to dress it up in something that would confuse us, you know, make us look upon it in an anthropomorphic way. It's kind of like it was like a high-tech scarecrow, is the way I take that monster. Except that I have heard reports of a couple of days later when the headdress was removed, and it appears that it was a vehicle for the alien to get around. Right, the bottom part of it was a stand of sorts into which the alien stood, and so the garb that it was dressing up in was, as I said, like a scarecrow to hide his real form and the fact that he was riding around on this little levitating machine at the same time. It's a very intriguing story. But the other thing about him was he stunk. He made people sick from his smell.
And this is
one issue that people really have to consider in close encounters with UFO is that they are very dangerous. I tell people, don't stare at UFOs. Can burn your eyes and create blisters on your cornea. Don't get close. There's tremendous heat. There's radiation.
Yep. I remember that. There's a lot of heat coming from certain areas.
Toxic smells. Acrid.
The one that we saw that was literally only about 150 feet above our heads, 60
mm-hmm.
feet across, it emitted a very bluey white light, a brilliant white blue light. No
mm-hmm.
noise, no sound, no smell, no heat.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
You mentioned an interesting thing. I want to relate something to you. In my work as UFO Digest editor, I'm an intersection point for hundreds of UFO photos that come across my desk from people all over the world. And invariably they say, oh, I was just taking this picture, and I didn't see it when I took it, but here, look at this UFO that appeared in my picture. And, but I have another fellow, a friend in Virginia. His name is Tom Waters. And this man has a knack for taking a camera, and just on a certain day or certain days, he goes out and he's got a feeling and he goes click, 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 and he starts catching all these amazing UFOs in this area in Virginia, not far from Langley. And so I published some of his photographs, and I finally said to him in an email, I said, Tom, you really seem to have a knack like or an intuition like a lot of people do. They just have a I feel like taking a picture sensation, and they get a UFO without seeing it. But he said to me, Robert, you might think I'm crazy, but I think I can smell them. I said, what? He said, I think I can smell them. When I come out and I smell a certain air, a certain freshness, electricity, or some sweet smell in the air, I don't know how to describe it, but when I smell that smell, I grab my camera and I start shooting pictures of the sky in different places, and he keeps capturing UFOs. So I think that this subliminal faculty, we don't pay enough attention to our sense of smell, which is really the primordial sense. When we come into life, that's the one that's strongest. We can't focus our eyes. We don't understand what sounds are. We think we're everything, you know, our sense of touch comes into, it shrinks into our bodies. But the sense of smell is how we really communicate with the world and know mom from dad or strangers. But I think people are operating, and some people are more sensitive. Their brains are more connected to these more subtle faculties. So this
I agree with that. I remember one day just tidying my bedroom up and my brain was saying, take some pictures, and it just wouldn't stop knocking me, so I took some pictures. When I zoomed in, I had taken like about 7 or 8 pictures of this silver sphere and the little black object, and the two of them morphed into each other. Oh, if I'd have got a video of it, it wouldn't have come out because of my camera phone, but the pictures actually got it, you know, so... I agree, but I don't know how I knew they were there.
I was going to answer something for a Chip when you get a second, too. I just wanted to...
Go ahead, Thomas.
Okay. You were asking earlier about, you know, information regarding behavior and how this takes place and how you're accompanied or handled, I guess is a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, before we run out of time, what I can tell you, when I was in this area, which was probably 15 by 15, I try to be very careful with this because I was younger, so things seemed to be bigger, but it was a very squared off room. There was a figure or an ET or being, or I guess it looked like half, if I were to describe it, it really did not look like what you'd see today online as being a gray, but a cross between maybe a person, something in a mix, and with an overbite. They didn't have the pointed chin. It looked like it had an overbite type of structure to its face. It was to my left. Now, when I was, say, escorted or handled or accompanied, I guess, out, it was very orchestrated, almost militant, I guess, if I were to give it a term. And I was walked out this room, and I was taken to the right. And the figure was not in front of me. It was just off my left shoulder. And I walked down this hallway that went to the right and then bowed it back around to the left. When I was going down this hallway, I saw my brother. My brother was standing next to a wall. And then again, Alien Mysteries kind of twisted this too. But it was actually, he was to my left, not in front of me. And there was a figure to his left. So when I walked by my brother, who was actually on this curved wall, if you will, he had a figure to his left, too. And then when I got to the end or was taken to the end of this hallway, I'd say the being that was with me, released me, if you will, had gone back, and now I was in the company of another. So it's almost as if there's certain areas that they're responsible for, or a zone, I guess is a good way to word it, and you're taken from one zone or area to another, and then you are... given, or that person has, that being or figure has responsibility from you from that point on, is how it was to me. And yet, after speaking to my brother, whenever we were around another being, and maybe you can ask this when you interview others, They were always to our left, never to the right, always on our left side. And my brother and I both remember that. And something else I wanted to mention is that we were shown this willow tree image, which has forever been etched in my mind. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We had a black and white TV back then, so this was just amazing. It went from like 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock. It's a huge image that was shown to us. It must have been 15 feet high and maybe 30 feet wide. My mother never remembers seeing it at all. She doesn't remember being on the craft at that point. She remembers 69, but not 66 or 67. Yet she went out not long afterwards, after this happened to us, and planted a willow tree at a drinking hole for our horses right off the kitchen where she could see it every morning. We'd see it in the, you know, over breakfast, lunch, whatever. And my mother actually came in to, after 69, after which finally caused us to sell the home and everything, to give me a kiss goodnight. And I had been sleeping with a fork. That's how scared I was of, and I think maybe because of the seeing this image of this willow tree, which still to this day, I have a love-hate relationship with it, I lunged up and I caught my mother in the face with this fork. Now, just to give you an idea, that's what it was like for us, but at the same time, my mother basically mirrored what we saw on a craft, yet she doesn't ever remember being there. I'm thinking she must have been, you know, but she doesn't really remember it. Yet my brother and I remember an awful lot from being, from a very young age. Yet my mother only remembers parts. You know, she doesn't remember what my brother and I remember at that moment, you know, seeing that big image on the. So I'm wondering if maybe adults don't, maybe children are more of interest, obviously, and maybe it's because of their makeup, maybe because of the DNA, maybe there's extractions being taken, maybe there's something being mutually exchanged, and for that part of it, maybe we're more awake, maybe we're more aware.
Yeah, you know, no, well, that's another good point you make right there about the abduction of kids or in general more often happening than adults, because I know what you had a big break until 2009. You know, I'm kind of in the same boat with that. You know, I had a long time with nothing, and then, you know, my son turns one, and lo and behold, I'm being put back in my bed one night and can't see beyond the edges of the bed. You know, it's all black and being lowered in like a puppet, you know, and that's all that's happened since then. So
well,
I definitely think that
children.
They take. What's that? Go ahead.
Definitely something with children. I mean, my son was actually in the hospital not that long ago for a hole in his sinuses that they finally found with an X-ray. And he had been these almost looks like half, maybe 5 or 6 inch long membrane that would come out of his nose. I actually sent Robert a picture of it. And it for whatever reason, he actually played football. And he got hit at a football game and bled terribly, and it wouldn't stop. And he ended up, in the emergency room. And that's when they took the X-ray, found this hole up in his sinuses. That's a pretty good-sized hole, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And this piece had come out of his nose that was probably 5 or 6 inches long, if not longer than that. And it was about half, if you broke a pencil in half, basically, is what it looked like, only it was like a white, reddish membrane. And when we were in the hospital, we actually had it, and we had actually been looking at it and grabbed the baggie and stuck it in a baggie, and it just kind of dissolved into nothing afterwards. But he had this thing that would, it's terrible, these nosebleeds. And he had it, the first time he had the nosebleed, he was about a month old. And my wife and I were in bed, Angela, and what we thought was the same dream. And we woke up at the same time, and we had ran out of the bedroom and got down the hallway, and when we got to the living room, the rocking chair was moving, and all the cabinets were open in the kitchen, which is very strange. And then we went into my son's room, and he was face down in the crib, and he was only, I'm going to guess, 8 or 9 weeks old, and we never put him to bed face down, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, he was too weak to turn himself over, and he was in a pool of blood. So that was the first time we really noticed that. But to this day, things have been happening with him. He has been testing off the charts. He was in the 127th percentile, and he was able to do. He was doing grade 13 math in fifth grade and beat an unbeaten chess pro. And the most recent thing that happened with him, and I look for this, and my brother looks for this too, is that I had something happen in my room, which was basically, and actually was in UFO Digest. It was one of the first things I talked about, where I actually found my feet up near a ceiling fan, and my entire body was like the room had just had no atmosphere to it. It was weightless. And I remember actually looking at a clock and seeing 2:33, 2:34 on the clock, and I was having trouble breathing. It was almost as if my throat would not function, is what it was like. It wasn't as if I could move my hands. I could move my head a little bit, and the room was somewhat lit up. And I remember actually I have a tanning bed, and I actually had been over my tanning bed. I was talking to Yvonne Smith about it. She actually tried to do some hypnosis with me and stuff, and, you know, trying to see if I went out the window and all this. Actually, what I think was happening is I think I was actually, and I could be wrong, I'm not an expert, but I feel like I had just maybe come to moments too early before I was being returned from something. And this was actually something that happened in line with my brother's incident, but I don't talk about it much because my brother has the evidence on his side of it. And this is something I was actually saving for my book to talk about. But anyway, mm-hmm. at that time, I had white sweatpants on with stripes on it, and I very seldom ever went to bed like that, you know, but it was just a hot summer night, and I remember seeing my sweatpants on my legs. And what was also interesting is that if my sweatpants did not have, like, an elastic around the bottom of it, they were loose. So my legs were up towards the ceiling fan, and I mean within maybe 5 or 6 inches from it, and I did not see my pants like sliding off my leg, and you would think that they would. If I took my sweatpants and lifted mm-hmm. my leg up, my pants would slide back. And yeah. So there was no, you know, and I was aware of this. I'm thinking this to myself. I'm like, do I feel hands under me? Do I feel a board under me? I was trying to, decipher how is this? That's how aware I was about this, and I was in a panic and I couldn't breathe. And so anyway, I don't know. Maybe I finally caught my breath. The room went dark, and I jumped out of bed and I ran into the bathroom. And I was sitting on the toilet. I ran to water and I was throwing water on my face. And I was like, just wow, you know, just. And then I heard this scream from the other room, which is the bonus room over the garage, and it was my son. So I ran down the hallway and I opened up the door, and my son was sitting up, right in the bed. And he had a friend over, Thomas, actually, from Florida, and visiting. And my son had said that he thought or he saw what looked like almost like a silk sheet coming down from the ceiling over his bed, as if he was to go through like almost like a window. But the way he described it was like a silk look to it, almost like a silk pillowcase, if you would. And he was drenched in sweat, and he was in I'm trying to understand why he would be that, but he felt something, and that's what I mean about what you feel, you know, that comes with what happens. And so Thomas was on the mattress on the floor, and I'm like, you know, and he's like staring at me, and and he's looking at my son, and he tells me that moments, or what he thinks was moments earlier, he saw what looked like lights coming in my son's window, and he went to wake my son, and my son wouldn't respond, and then ended up, I guess, passing out or falling asleep, or however you want to word it, on the mattress on the floor. So if you look at the time frame from what Thomas had said, it corresponds with what happened to me in the master bedroom, and then moments later, I hear a scream from my son. So there were three people, and this happened in Tennessee. This happened not even 7 miles from Oak Ridge, which Y-12, which is what Robert owns. That's where I live. I live right next to Y-12, which is one of the larger nuclear power plants. And I'll tell you something else that's really kind of strange, and I'm only going to tell you this because you're out of the country. My son's girlfriend's father worked and was a head of the nuclear waste disposal project for Area 51. So So when we talk about irradiation and nuclear waste, I have been talking about it. I have been trying to make sense of what it is and what types of radiation there are and types of nuclear waste. And we even got into how they're disposing of plutonium and mixing it with glass and so on, so how it's buried in, you know, over solid rock beds from volcanoes and that sort of thing. But we do look into it, and we are trying to make sense of a lot of things. But this particular night happened right here in Tennessee. And so what was happening, I think, has affected my son a lot. I mean, obviously, I mean, he's starting to experience things, and he's starting to have some foresight. He's demonstrating some things that no one else in our family has ever been able to do, and he's accurate. There was about 2 months ago, I got a call from my son who was very shaken, and he said, "Dad, are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. You know, don't worry about it. I'm going to bed in a little bit." And he wouldn't believe that I was okay. He jumped in his car, and he was maybe half an hour away, and this was about 1 o'clock in the morning, I guess. And he got within a half a mile of the house, and he saw these backup of cars. And sure enough, right on the corner of my property, and I'm not, I mean, we're talking, I don't know, maybe 150 yards from my back door, there an SUV that was flipped over, and it had lost control in this corner and was upside down pole, and there was a woman hanging out of the sunroof. So my son knew or felt that, I'm going to say felt it, so strongly that he drove a half an hour at 1 o'clock in the morning. There was another time that when he was very young, that he came running in the bedroom and was telling me how I had a little bass tracker on a boat. And he said that the boat was gone and that there was a white little Toyota with no hubcaps on it. And he was scared of it, you know, that something was wrong. And so I let him, you know, he spent the night in my bedroom or whatever. And about a week and a half later, I had sold the bass tracker to his football coach when he was playing for the Orange Bowl Youth League. And sure enough, we spoke to a neighbor, Nancy, who had just been broken into, and the car that was identified was a white car. And sure enough, there were he described it basically to a T, and we even saw it. So there is something to my son's abilities, and when you look at the report that was done, and I'm mentioning this because we're talking about children, and we don't have much time left, so I thought this would be a good time to mention it. That this is very genetic. This is very biologically driven. There's definitely something to that. And I think that there are a lot of senses, and I think that we have a lot of animals that have abilities, and chameleons and different species of animals that have an awful lot to offer. And if you could take those strengths from these different animals and be able to combine them and develop a designer being and be able to utilize these senses and abilities, you could design any being you wanted to be, a worker or what have you. But I think the issue that is happening, and what I think is the problem, is I think that there isn't a baseline. I think there's a problem having these figures or beings or crossbred animals or these designer beings surviving and being able to have offspring, because there isn't a solid base for them to work off of. And I think that's why the Rh negative factor and certain, which I think is the original bloodline of man, quite honestly, it doesn't trace back to anything. And then I think if you start with that, and there's 9 of us in our family are Rh negative. 9.
My mum's Rh negative. I'm not. But when I talk to people, all the people that I kind of like look after, when we discuss that, if they're not Rh negative, I don't think I've ever come across the case that isn't, where they've got a parent that is. So there's a direct link to the Rh factor.
84% of the Basque people have Rh negative factor, and about that and type O. Yes, the blood factor is very important. I wanted to address the same question that is your name Steve or Chip?
Chip.
That you mentioned about the controllers, the handlers. Unfortunately, abductees or experiencers, whichever term you wish to use,
sure.
Have to suffer attention of two control groups. You know, one is the alien intelligence group that comes to take them, and the second one is the government follow-up team that comes around and tries
good point.
To sweep everything up under the rug. And both are done in very military manner, you know.
Yep.
There's definitely a team element to the alien abductions. Each ET
right.
has a specific function, works almost robotically in the process of, let's call it, the snatch, you know. And it's fascinating to hear from you, Chance, saying that he felt like a white sheet was coming down on him, because people who have been or are abducted regularly report first a flash of light. It may be white or it may be blue.
Mm-hmm.
And then a feeling as if they're wrapped up in a membrane or jello, and that the atmosphere is also suddenly sticky or denser, as if they're moving through water, but they can breathe in it. And then they're just gone. And that's part of...
Yeah, that's what I said earlier. It almost feels like you're sucked up in an ocean wave. You can't,
right.
There's pressure on you, and it's a cloud of white, but there's a pressure on you at the same time.
Right, right. The other part is this. For them to come in and take somebody in about 7 to 10 seconds, that really has to be teamwork, you know? You can't have two little ETs fighting for the same leg or the same arm, you know? They're going to come in like a SWAT team, basically. You know,
yeah.
They each know
yep.
their specific function, boom, 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 they do
mm-hmm.
it, they take it, they snatch it. Out the window with the Linda Cortil case down here in New York, the famous one, 12 stories up, where the UN, Cuellar, remember his name?
Mm-hmm.
Perez the Cuellar was driving past a building on the Lower East Side on Water Street. The two limousines broke down at the same time. Both limousine drivers got out. So your car broke down? Yeah, my car broke down too. What's going on? Let's open up the hood. They open up the hoods. Nothing seems to be wrong, but they started to see flashes of blue light coming off the hood or in the roof of the car. They looked up, and there was a UFO parked outside the 12th story of this high-rise building in New York. And a blue light was being shined into the building, and they saw a woman floating out and being taken by the UFO. And there was a huge cover-up for years and years and years to hide the identity of the United Nations dignitary whose car broke down when this happened. So it seems to me like it was a perfectly staged event. If you think about it, if the ETs want to get a message to the United Nations, they say, all right, let's give him a show, all right? Break down his car right there. Zoom. There he is, stuck on the street. Two cars. And then they put on a light show, and they snatch this woman right before his eyes. So how can the UN cannot not take this seriously? But it is such a delicate matter.
They do, right? I think
they do, but it's such a delicate matter culturally. The culture shock is what they're afraid of.
Yes.
But I think we're ready for it.
That 1992, that October 2nd, 1992, a lot of people have told me that was actually, you know, our family's case was mentioned in, was actually the very first attempt for disclosure in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And
it's an ongoing process.
Yeah. But it's been something that I think, and you probably know more about it than any, you know, certainly than I do about the going-ons and the amount of conversations in the Parapsychology Society, which I guess you weren't really. I don't even know if it still exists. I mean, maybe you.
That's why I'm very interested in following up to find out, because you know it makes perfect sense that the Parapsychology Society would be the contact society. You know, one of the things that the military feared most was the telepathic element of the UFO experience. As far back as 1952, the U.S. Navy learned that people who were being abducted, I think I mentioned this to Thomas earlier, I know I did, that people who were being abducted had unique genetic characteristics, and many, if not most of them, were people who had a Celtic, Teutonic, Anglo bloodline mixed with a Native American bloodline, predominantly Cherokee,
Chippewa.
Chippewa in your case. Yeah, the East, and I found is this mixture, they found, CIA discovered, that this particular a mixture of genetic traits from the Old World and the New World, that's the way I describe it, ancient European bloodlines, Celtic bloodlines, Western European bloodline, with a Native American bloodline, produced the most potently psychic person, and gifted in many ways, apparently. You see, DNA has intelligence, and when DNA is given a natural opportunity to mix, it makes the best choices possible. And that's what I think is happening when, in America, America is a pool, a hybrid pool. Who of us, see, I describe myself as an unhyphenated American. You know, I'm Spanish and Jewish on my mother's side. I'm German, English, and Slavic on my father's side. What label did he put on that? Vulcan. You know, no hyphens for me. I'm an unhyphenated American, and that's good enough for me. But the bloodline thing is intriguing with Thomas and the Reed family. I was telling Tom that I read a book in the 1970s by John Keel, which was one of the early books detailing CE3s, so close encounters and physical encounters with aliens and abductions. And one of the things that John Keel mentioned in his book was that he had found that on one particular day in the early 1950s, there were three abductions in the United States by flying saucers. That was the term of the day. It wasn't called UFO. Flying saucers came and aliens abducted three individuals in far-flung reaches of the United States, but all of their names, the family names, were Reeve or Reeves, R-E-E-V-E, and with an S. And all of us know that those are the two names of the Superman, the most famous Superman characters. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know? So, and then the Reed family. So, there. And I told Tom, the reason we have surnames in the West, it's a patronymic tracing system, tracking male bloodlines, male DNA. That's where the Catholic Church is expert. You know, the baptismal certificate, it's actually a DNA tracking device. Right throughout the course of Catholic history, so they're tagging bloodlines and tracking them along the patronymic, the father's name bloodline, whereas Jews practice following the matrilineal, and to be a Jew you have to be married from a Jew not married but born of a Jewish woman. So each group is tracking a particular bloodline, and who, you know, look at the Gospel of St. Luke. It starts with the genealogy of Jesus, whom I believe is also involved in this to a very high degree. I believe that Jesus was the perfection of the Adamic genome, that the Adamic genome was tainted, it was intentionally damaged by this reptilian intrusion, and that the whole history culminating in Christ, the coming of Christ, was that coming of Christ signaled the reascension of man and the perfection of his genome through processes that were metaphysical and yogic. I believe Jesus knew yoga and practiced Taoism, because Jesus taught the way, said the way, the truth, and life. And the Tao teaches the same thing, Tai Chi. Mm. So I find that the middle road, but definite extraterrestrial intervention in the birth of Jesus and John the Baptist, with the angels announcing their births and so on and so forth. So I think we're seeing with clearer eyes, looking backward on our history, and we're reaching a point where it's going to climax. I believe we are approaching a climax point in the next 10 years.
Hey, about the bloodline, did you know that O negative blood or Rh negative or O negative is also the only bloodline that's actually tracked by the U.S. government?
The purported reason is the blue baby syndrome, you know? That's the
universal donor.
Right? Yeah, and you're the universal donor. Right.
Yep. So it's also tracked by the government. You're really getting it from both ends.
Yep. Oh, when I say something about memory, it's very important. Everyone here has mentioned the fogginess of memory and the difficulty in remembering things. I was having a conversation with Richard Dolan about a year and a half ago, and I mentioned this problem, you know, that people, and I said, you know, the ETs, they seem to have a way of erasing your memories. And he said, you know, not exactly. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's not exactly that. They apparently have a drug that will prevent your memory from being recorded. And I said to myself, my God, that is really genius. If you know how memory is recorded, the brain creates dendrites, a little, you know, it's a biochemical event. You have an experience and your brain says, oh, this is worth remembering. It grows a little foot, a dendrite, a little nerve. And so Richard Dolan, author of UFOs in the National Security State, says to me, their drug prevents the memory from being recorded. That's physically, see? However, I believe the soul and the body do remember the insult. Our perceptions are still rolling, and there are many, many ways to record. Memory is recorded on many levels. We have
on a molecular level, yeah.
Atomic. We have emotional memory.
Yeah.
We have visual or auditory memory. It's a subject for a whole show on its own. But this is brilliant, this idea. And here's the other problem. The Air Force and the controllers, Men in Black, do the same thing. And what I found out from the Larry Warren story at Rendlesham Forest, there's this whole theater thing that happens. The person's abducted. A real alien takes them. They do the real alien operations on them. They put them back. Government finds out, oh, this person was taken. We better go take him and find out what he got, right? So they take him, hold him. They give him sodium pentothal or some truth serum, and they debrief him, and they get all the information, the real stuff that happened to the individual. And then to suppress that information, they'll drug him again, they'll bring in another alien, and they'll go through a fake alien, a staged alien abduction to befuddle the person and cover up the real abduction by the memory of the false abduction and seal that thing shut so that nobody else knows. That's how far it's gone. And that's from Left at Eastgate, the story of Larry Warren at Rendlesham.
Actually, Robert, Larry is one of my best friends. He only lived a few miles away from me.
Well,
I did a lot.
My regards.
I will. Yeah, I will.
Very brave man.
He's an absolute superstar. He's carried the can for that for years, and now it's all come out, and he's like the prodigal son, rather than the idiot that they all tried to make out that he was. So yeah, I'm really proud of him.
The entrancement of abductees is a fascinating field, and it can happen in many ways. The entrancement, let me tell you one of the most fascinating ones I've ever heard of. A woman who is living in Tennessee she was out on her porch and saw a UFO in the sky. She saw the UFO come down and land across the road, and then she was terrified. She was absolutely scared witless by seeing this UFO land across from her house on the other side of the road. But she's mesmerized by the experience at the same time. You can't believe it's happening. It's scary. It's fascinating. It's out of this world. She said that the door opened, an alien walked out, and she was really mortified and her legs wanted to run. But then the alien made a sound, a whistle. That was such a beautiful pitch. When she heard that note, she could not resist, and her legs started walking against her will right in the door of the UFO. Wow. There's the opposite of that, where the UFO will make a sound that will absolutely terrorize the person and just make them wet their pants and run crazily away. I've heard descriptions of Viet Cong when the B-52s were coming. They said your legs just started running, your brain is gone, your body wants to survive. And that happened to a Polish colonel and his son during a fishing fishing tour they were doing by a lakeside in Poland about 10, 11 years ago. I remember this one so vividly because these people got the best photographs of UFOs up to that time. The father, a colonel in the Polish Air Force, went bonkers. He heard this sound, and he almost lost consciousness. His legs started running. He wet his pants, and he lost awareness. When he came to awareness, he saw his son was wading in the lake up to his armpits with a camera following the UFOs, witlessly. Just crazily obsessed with taking pictures of the UFOs, which I'm very grateful for, because there were some of the best up to
that. I've actually had that myself, Robert. When we had the encounter in Wales, when my son got scared, we took the children back in the house, and when we went back in the house, John and Daniel started watching TV, and Steve started doing the dishes, and the two kids just started playing, and I was like looking at everybody thinking, what are you doing? So I decided to walk back out by myself, and I walked along the garden and right back to where I was stood before, which was directly underneath this this object. And I heard something run up behind me and bump into me. And I was running before I even knew I was running, and I couldn't see. I was blind. I'd gone blind. I was absolutely that scared that I couldn't see a damn thing, you know. And like that, to me, but everybody was sort of scarred by everything as much as I was, but I was the only one who got that fright, so I was never understand why everybody else was so damaged when they were all inside the house, and that only happened to me, and we'd only just been outside looking at these things in the sky, which is kind of mind-blowing in itself, but it didn't seem like it at the time. It seemed like the most normal thing in the world to be happening. We just were quite excited by it and not afraid at all. Not until, well, the children were. They were the only ones with any sense, you know. And, so, you know, that was what really took the top of my head off forever, really, that thing. And I think we've only got 2 minutes left.
So, well, it's been a pleasure.
It certainly has. It's just not long enough.
there's so many fields of investigation, but I think that tonight, listening to Thomas and the details that he brought out, and the correlations that Chip and you and I have, I think we really got a lot of information together. And it's this process that I like to call cross-pollination of information. When we share information openly, we each give each other complementary information. Not saying, hey, you're great. They're saying, this fits this better, and we get a better perspective and better view of the overall plan, the overall scheme.
That's right, and that's why I don't trust anybody who tells any abductee not to talk to any other abductee, to keep yourself pure, all the rest of it. I think, what's your game? That's the way that we recover, and that's the way we find where we belong, because after something like that, you don't feel like you belong anywhere, not even on the planet, you know?
To respect other people. To respect other people when they give you these stories, it's really a gift. If somebody's is trusting you enough to share a story, the least you can do is listen and don't ridicule, don't sarcasm. You don't know what the person has gone through.
No one knows any answers. So those that scoff, you know, they're in the same position as us, but they're just deciding not to believe in it because that's a much safer place to be mentally.
It's unsettling.
In closing, I'd like to share something with you. I'm sorry.
Go on, Thomas.
Something that I found to be really interesting. And the first time, if you look at UFO casebook and you look at our case, you'll see that it actually references the 1950s because of my mother's encounter in Maine. And she was 15 years old, and it was 1954. Well, when I went back to Sheffield, Mass, with my attorney, actually, to talk to the new homeowner, because they were going to actually do a film there, shoot there, and make sure that was going to be okay and familiarize myself with the area, I found that he actually had moved our old house about 400 yards up the top of the hill.
And so in talking with him, we went to leave and we took some pictures of the property. And of all things, when we lived there, the house had no street number. There, it was just the Boardman Street house in Sheffield, Mass. We get back to the house and we're looking, or back here in Tennessee, and we're looking at the pictures. The house now has an address, 1554, the age of my mother and the year that it first happened. And I just thought that was so, uncanny and odd. I just, little things like that, I just, and just
they're part of the mystery.
Yeah, it was just of all things, right? It was just unbelievable. And
well, I lived in a house called the Triangle when I was 12 and I had activity going on. And at the top of that street, I found three crop circles in a field that basically formed a triangle, you know. Mm. And the number three has just followed me forever, all my houses.
Like 19 has always followed me, the number 19.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? We have all these little mysteries that follow us around. They're like little flies around Lionel's blanket.
it's what makes us, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
right, well, it's been an absolutely wonderful show, as usual, with you, Thomas, and it's been lovely to talk to you, Robert, because we've never spoken before, have we? Yeah, I'd like to talk to you some more, actually, so I might be in touch with you. I did send you an album of my UFO photos, just a few of them, because I thought you might be interested.
Oh, sure. And
Chip?
Yes.
Thanks for riding shotgun.
No problem. Thanks for having me on. And both guests are more than worthy than a couple hour spot on their own. That's for sure. They can definitely carry it without a doubt.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
down many things. There's also as with Robert as a psychotherapist there, I'd love to talk about the culture of ufology.